Vidyadaryaschan amritur apsarobi samamuda jagu kinara gandharva tushtuhu siddhacharana vidyadaryaschan amritur apsarobi samamuda. The Kinaras and Gandharvas began to sing auspicious songs. The Siddhas and Charanas offered auspicious prayers. And the Vidyadharis, along with the Apsaras, began to dance in jubilation. Please repeat. The Kinaras and Gandharvas began to sing auspicious songs. The Siddhas and Charanas offered auspicious prayers. And the Vidyadharis, along with the Apsaras, began to dance in jubilation. So I'll read the next two texts. Mumuchur munayo deva samanam si mudanvita mandam mandam jaladara jagarjur anusagaram nishite tama udbute jayamane janardane devakyam devarupinyam vishnu sarva guhashaya avirasid yata prachyam dishindur iva pushkala. Translation. The demigods and great saintly persons showered flowers in a joyous mood, and clouds gathered in the sky and very mildly thundered, making sounds like those of the ocean's waves. Then the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, who is situated in the core of everyone's heart, appeared from the heart of Devaki in the dense darkness of night, like the full moon rising on the eastern horizon, because Devaki was of the same category as Sri Krishna. Report by Srila Prabhupada. As stated in the Brahma Samhita 537, Ananda Chinmaya Rasa Pratibhavatabhis Tabirya Eva Nijandrupa Taya Kalabi Galoka Eva Nivasatya Kilatma Bhuto Govinda Madi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. This verse indicates that Krishna and his entourage are of the same spiritual potency, Ananda Chinmaya Rasa. Krishna's father, his mother, his friends, the cowherd boys, and the cows are all expansions of Krishna, as will be explained in the Brahma Vimohana Lila. When Brahma took away Krishna's associates to test the supremacy of Lord Krishna, the Lord expanded himself again in the forms of the many cowherd boys and calves, all of whom, as Brahma saw, were Vishnu Murtis. Devaki is also an expansion of Krishna, and therefore this verse says, Devakyam Devarupinyam Vishnu Sava Guhashaya. At the time for the Lord's appearance, the great sages and demigods, being pleased, began to shower flowers. At the seashore there was the sound of mild waves, and above the sea there were clouds in the sky, which began to thunder very pleasingly. When things were adjusted like this, Lord Vishnu, who is residing within the heart of every living entity, appeared in the darkness of night as the Supreme Personality of Godhead before Devaki, who appeared as one of the demigoddesses. The appearance of Lord Vishnu at that time could be compared to the rising of the full moon in the sky on the eastern horizon. The objection may be raised that since Lord Krishna appeared on the eighth day of the waning moon, there could be no rising of the full moon. In answer to this, it may be said that Lord Krishna appeared in the dynasty which is in the hierarchy of the moon. Therefore, although the moon was incomplete on that night, because of the Lord's appearance in the dynasty wherein the moon is himself the original person, the moon was in an overjoyous condition. So by the grace of Krishna, he could appear as a full moon. To welcome the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the waning moon became a full moon in jubilation. Instead of Deva Rupinyam, Some texts of Srimad Bhagavatam clearly say Vishnu Rupinyam. In either case, the meaning is that Devaki has the same spiritual form as the Lord. The Lord is Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha, and Devaki is also Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. Therefore, no one can find any fault in the way the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha, appeared from the womb of Devaki. Those who are not in full knowledge that the appearance and disappearance of the Lord are transcendental, janma karma chame divyam, are sometimes surprised that the Supreme Personality of Godhead can take birth like an ordinary child. Actually, however, the Lord's birth is never ordinary. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is already situated within the core of everyone's heart as Antaryami, the Supersoul. Thus, because he was present in full potency in Devaki's heart, he was also able to appear outside her body. One of the twelve great personalities is Bhishma Dev, Svayambhur Narada Shambhu, Kumara Kapilominu, Pralado Janako Bhishma. In Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhishma, a great authority to be followed by devotees, says that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated in the core of everyone's heart, just as the sun may be on everyone's head. Yet although the sun may be on the heads of millions and millions of people, this does not mean that the sun is variously situated. Similarly, because the Supreme Personality of Godhead has inconceivable potencies, he can be within everyone's heart, and yet not be situated variously. Ekat Vam Anupashyata, Ishopanishad 7. The Lord is one, but he can appear in everyone's heart by his inconceivable potency. Thus, although the Lord was within the heart of Devaki, he appeared as her child. According to the Vishnu Purana, therefore, as quoted in the Vaishnava Toshini, the Lord appeared like the sun, Anugrahasya, Anugrahasaya. The Brahma Samhita 5.35 confirms that the Lord is situated even within the atom, Andantarastha Paramanu Chayantarastham. He is situated in Mathura, in Vaikuntha, and in the core of the heart. Therefore, one should clearly understand that he did not live like an ordinary child in the heart or womb of Devaki, nor did he appear like an ordinary human child, although he seemed to do so in order to bewilder asuras like Kamsa. The asuras wrongly think that Krishna took birth like an ordinary child and passed away from this world like an ordinary man. Such asuric conceptions are rejected by persons in knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ajopisam avayatma bhutanam ishvaropisam. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord is Aja, unborn, and he is the supreme controller of everything. Nonetheless, he appeared as the child of Devaki. This verse describes the inconceivable potency of the Lord, who appeared like the full moon. Understanding the special significance of the appearance of the Supreme Godhead, one should never regard him as having taken birth like an ordinary child. Umangyana tamarandasya jananjana shavakaya chakshu militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manajristan stapitam yena bhutale swayam rupakadamayam didati svapadantikam. So actually, I'll read this translation. The demigods and great saintly persons showered flowers in a joyous mood, and clouds gathered in the sky and very mildly thundered, making sounds like those of the ocean's waves. Then the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, who is situated in the core of everyone's heart, appeared from the heart of Devaki in the dense darkness of night, like the full moon rising on the eastern horizon, because Devaki was of the same category as Sri Krishna. So these verses are describing the actual appearance of Lord Krishna as the son of Devaki, Devaki Nandana. And Srila Prabhupada is explaining in great detail the transcendental nature of Krishna and his appearance. It's very important to understand this. And so to understand it, one has to understand the fundamental philosophy regarding the nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his relationship with the material existence. Because if that is not understood, then it will not be really possible to understand what is happening with the birth of Lord Krishna. Materially inclined people, or people who simply have a material conception of things, whatever their inclination may be, will not be able to properly understand the nature of Krishna's appearance. So they will tend to think that Krishna must have taken birth as an ordinary living being. And there are many different ways of conceiving of this. One can imagine, for example, that Krishna took birth as perhaps as some kind of demigod. One can readily imagine that perhaps he wasn't just an ordinary human being. But one would conceive that some kind of entity entered into the womb of Devaki and developed there and then was born and proceeded to perhaps exhibit various mystical powers or something of this kind. So this would not be a correct understanding of what was really happening. Actually, because of this material conception of Krishna, there are whole schools of religionists who declare that the Supreme Personality of Godhead could not take birth, and thus they reject this account. For example, this is true of the Sikhs in India. Now, I don't know if Guru Nanak, who was their original leader, preached anything like this, but at least the present-day Sikhs will say that the Supreme Personality of Godhead could not have taken birth. That is simply not possible. So this is due to a misconception concerning what is actually happening here. Now, Srila Prabhupada points out here that Krishna is one. This word ekatvam is used, which refers to oneness. Eka is one. So this is an important point to consider. One aspect of the Supreme is non-duality. The Supreme cannot be made up of many different parts which are all divided from one another, because in that case you would not have one ultimate Supreme Being. You would just have various parts which are interacting in some way and which are possibly in conflict. So one basic understanding regarding the Supreme Absolute Truth is that the Absolute Truth has perfect oneness. So if that is true, then one can raise the question, how could something that has perfect oneness appear as an apparently human child, taking birth at a particular time and exhibiting variegated features such as hands, arms, legs, and so forth? Because these are different parts, and it would seem that this entity is appearing in a particular place and not some other place. It would seem that Krishna was now within the walls of this particular prison of Kamsa, and that meant that he wasn't in another location. For example, later on we will read that Vasudev, fearing that Kamsa would come to kill Krishna, managed to escape from the palace of Kamsa, actually by Krishna's arrangement. All the guards were asleep and so forth. And he then took him to Vrindavan and hid him there. So it would seem that, well, first he was in Kamsa's palace and not in Vrindavan, and then he was taken there by Vasudev. So how can you say that this is the Supreme Absolute Truth? How can the Supreme Absolute Truth be in a certain location on the earth? So these questions will be raised. So Srila Prabhupada is pointing out here that actually one point is that Krishna is always everywhere, and he was manifesting himself first within the heart of Devaki, and then as described here, he appeared before her. So, this actually leads to some fundamental considerations concerning the nature of space and the nature of matter, if you think about it. The basic understanding in the Vedic literature is that the absolute truth is the source of all different manifestations, and that includes the manifestation of space and matter. So we tend to think of space as something which exists sort of independently of everything else. It's just there somehow. And we tend to think of matter as being sort of stuff that's distributed through space. This is our basic conception. And of course, it's a natural conception to have given the kind of material senses that we're equipped with. We tend to see things in that way. We tend to see arrangements of matter in three dimensions. So, what one is implicitly thinking here is that space is absolute, and everything else appears within it and appears relative to the space in which it is situated. So, this then leads to the conception that if we're going to talk about God, we should imagine God as somehow being like space. And in fact, this leads to the conception of the Brahma-jyoti, or Brahman, as being the ultimate absolute truth. Because what is the Brahma-jyoti? As it is usually conceived by people, leaving aside the various fine philosophical points that are made about it. Well, one tends to think of a vast open space with light radiating through it. That's more or less the conception. It's just sort of like what you see when you go out on a day with bright sunlight and no clouds in the sky, and you sort of look up in the direction of the sun. You just see all this space with blazing light passing through it. So that's the conception that people then have of the absolute truth. Well, I'd point out, by the way, that Isaac Newton, just to give one example, conceived of God as being sort of identical with absolute space. Newton, in fact, endowed space with the power to move objects. Of course, he came up with the theory of gravitation, in which you have action at a distance, so that one thing in one location exerts a pull on something at a different location, and yet there's nothing between them. And so one can ask, how can that work physically? So this has been a great dilemma in physics ever since Newton's time. So Newton proposed that actually God is absolute space, and thus God is at the location of, say, both planets. And so if he wants, he can make them seem to move towards one another according to the force of gravity. That was Newton's idea. So he was also thinking of God in terms of space endowed with some kind of power to move and act upon things. However, according to the Vedic literature, the original cause of all causes is Krishna. Sarvakaranakaranam. Krishna is called Satchitananda Vigraha, and he's said to be the cause of all causes. So Krishna is the cause of space, and Krishna comes before any manifestation of space. And the Brahma Samhita describes in a very interesting way the relationship between Krishna and locations in space. It is stated there that all of the universes are contained within the form of Krishna, and Krishna, in his fullness, is situated within every atom within all of these universes. So, if you think about that for a moment, it seems initially to be somewhat paradoxical. How can it be that you have Krishna, and within Krishna there are universes, and within the universes there are atoms, and within each of the atoms there is Krishna? And not just part of Krishna, but Krishna in his fullness.
So it would seem then that within Krishna, then again, there are universes, and within those there are atoms, and within those there are Krishna, and so on. So you arrive at a conception which is practically inconceivable. It's very difficult to understand in ordinary terms. You can think of some mundane examples of this, however. For example, on some occasions you may have seen a painting in which, in the painting, there's a painting hanging on the wall, which happens to be the same painting. So within that, there's another one hanging on the wall, which is the same painting, and so on. And of course, unfortunately, in the painting, because it's made of crude globs of paint, if you look closely at the little painting on the wall, you'll see it's really not the same as the large painting because it doesn't have as much detail. So you can only go so many levels with this idea of the painting within the painting. But in the case of Krishna, there are unlimitedly many levels. So this gives the idea that actually Krishna is simultaneously fully present at every location in space, and he contains the whole thing also. So this is a kind of description of the nature of Krishna's oneness. And since we are speaking in material terms and using material examples, it is very difficult to properly understand this. We can sort of try and understand this oneness by chasing from one thing to another and showing how they connect, but always we fail to catch up with ourselves, so to speak. That is to say, Krishna is located at every point simultaneously, and all the points are within him. So you can see this sort of ties everything together, but in our descriptions, everything remains separate. But it's important at least to understand this idea that the original reality, absolute reality, is Krishna. And this is a reality with variegated form. One cannot conceive of Krishna as some kind of void or something like that. But Krishna has form and personality. But the entire manifestation of space and everything in it is within Krishna. And Krishna is simultaneously within it. So this is the nature and position of Krishna. So Krishna was always within the heart of Devaki, and he's always located everywhere. And he can manifest his form wherever and whenever he likes. So it's a question of the particular way in which he chooses to manifest himself. So it is described in this verse also that Devaki is of the same category as Krishna. So another problem which people would have in understanding how the Supreme Personality of Godhead can appear from gross matter is that they will think that matter and spirit are two different things, and matter is much inferior to spirit. Its properties and characteristics are in fact the very opposite of the properties of spirit. So how can it be that God, who is the supreme spiritual being, can appear within matter? This seems inappropriate, if not contradictory. So the point then is that Krishna was not actually appearing within matter. Of course, one point to make here is that matter itself is spiritual by nature. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he has eight separated energies. But these energies are actually his own energy. So they are actually transcendental in nature. So the thing that makes matter non-spiritual is the way in which matter is directed by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, matter is a spiritual energy which is being made to move and operate in such a way as to create a veil of illusion which covers the Supreme Lord from the vision of the conditioned souls. The basic idea here is that the conditioned souls essentially want to enjoy themselves independently of Krishna, And so Krishna creates a situation in which they are able to do this. So he does this by so manipulating some of his energy as to create the illusion that this energy is operating independently of any divine control. So the idea then is created in the minds of the conditioned souls that this material energy is something that's just working in an automatic and impersonal way and is manifesting everything within the universe. So in this way, Krishna disappears from the sight of the conditioned living entities. So this energy which is operating in this way we call matter, because it seems to be separate from God and it seems to be non-spiritual. But actually it is Krishna's energy which is being manipulated so as to create this impression. Actually, the word maya in Sanskrit also is used to refer to magic. For example, there are people called magicians who can perform various tricks. I've used the example of sawing a lady in half, which I actually saw once. The magician has this lady get into a sort of coffin in which her head sticks out one end and her feet stick out the other end. Then he closes it and he takes a big saw and starts sawing through the coffin. And he saws all the way through. And then the thing is mounted on wheels, so he then pulls the two parts of the coffin apart from one another, and you see the woman's feet still sticking out one end and her head sticking out the other. So it would seem that he sawed her in half. But they say that it's done with mirrors or something. I think there are trade secrets in this area. But the idea here is that some kind of apparatus is there which is used to create this illusion. So similarly, this material energy is an apparatus which is used by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to create the illusion of a material realm which is operating entirely in an automatic way without any intervention by God. So since this energy is actually spiritual, however, it is perfectly possible for Krishna to appear within it. It's actually his own energy, and as I was saying before, Krishna is always within it everywhere, and this energy is within Krishna. So another aspect here, though, is that this personality, Devaki, is a liberated spirit soul, and she is not at all contaminated by this tendency to be in material illusion. So her situation is that she is not like the ordinary conditioned souls who are separated from Krishna. So, let's see. Actually, one should... What time is it now?
Six.
Six. Are there any questions or points anyone would like to raise?
How can the space be a spiritual thing when it is the external energy of Krishna? Is it all the time contaminating?
Yeah, the point I was making... The material mind is doing it, but the soul isn't. Then it might be going on, but you wouldn't know about it.
So, to say that the material thoughts and feelings and so on are just occurring within the material mind is not really correct. What's happening there is that the material mind is part of Krishna's external energy, and it is essentially providing the program for material enjoyment. It's sort of like the automatic pilot of an airplane, you might say. At least one can make an analogy like that. Say somebody's flying an airplane and he's doing this in order to experience some enjoyment. But as part of his enjoyment, he doesn't want to have to pay individual attention to every single move that the airplane makes. So he has this automatic pilot which takes care of those things, and he just sets it so that he can sit there and enjoy the ride and so forth. So similarly, the mind is a much more elaborate automatic pilot which we program with all kinds of plans for enjoyment. So the mind is just full of these different plans. So these are the different potential thoughts, feelings, and desires that we want to manifest. So the whole thing is programmed within the mind. And as time goes on, these programs execute, just like in a computer, and we experience the whole show that's going on. So, but ultimately, it's the soul that does the experiencing. The mind itself is not actually in and of itself sentient. Of course, Krishna is there even within the mind and within everything else, and he knows everything. But his consciousness, of course, is Krishna's consciousness. That is, he's conscious of everything. So the mind itself is not conscious that, you know, I am Joe Smith and I want to do this. The mind is generating that program with all the details of what it takes to be Joe Smith, but ultimately it's the soul within that body that is thinking, I am Joe Smith. And of course, we say that the mind does the thinking, feeling, and willing, but we have to realize that the soul also does that. For example, if a soul becomes liberated and completely detached from the material elements, and say goes to Vaikuntha, you can't say, well, now that soul doesn't have a mind anymore, so it's not doing any more thinking, feeling, and willing. The soul is actually the conscious entity. So the mind is providing a program for our thinking, feeling, and willing. So actually, one philosophy that some people will put forward, I heard this advocated recently, is that my soul is on an exceedingly advanced spiritual level, but my mind and body are still, well, they're just material, and they're doing whatever it is, whatever it may be, you know, engaging in this activity and that activity. But my soul is on a very exalted plane. So they will argue like this, but actually that doesn't work, because whatever the material, as long as the soul is connected with the material body, whatever the material mind is generating and doing, that's what the soul is experiencing. But ultimately, it's the soul that is experiencing that.
Does the soul enjoy the material activities?
The soul is the only thing that enjoys the material activities. Nothing else does. Because the matter doesn't enjoy the material activities, and Krishna certainly doesn't enjoy them. The soul is the only thing that enjoys them, or tries to enjoy them. And that, of course, is the problem. Because the nature of material enjoyment is one is always trying to enjoy. Thinking, well, it's not quite right yet, but if only I could do this, if only that would happen, then I could enjoy. It doesn't, never happens. So any other question? So this is actually a very...
So you bring it back to the soul. You know, the soul is thinking, feeling, and willing.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say, well, that's the spiritual nature of Krishna, how can you say it's contaminated? In other words, the idea of how can there be any contamination within God? As you said earlier, it's all spiritual energy. Material is just a matter of consciousness. That consciousness comes from the soul. So how can there be something material in the soul? The soul is spiritual by nature.
So, the nature of the soul, and Krishna has set it up this way, is that the soul is capable of trying to act independently of Krishna. Now, you might say, well, why would Krishna allow for that? Certainly, if he wanted, he could have spirit souls who always cooperated with him fully, one would think. But in any case, the ontological situation is that the soul is a complete personality and in minute degree has all the qualities of the personality of Krishna himself, including the quality of being able to act independently. So Krishna has endowed the soul with these qualities. And there's this whole question here of free will, which always is very confusing to the philosophers. They always have enormous difficulties with it, and you can bring up all kinds of different paradoxes and so forth. But it would seem that Krishna has endowed the spirit souls with free will. So they're completely spiritual, and they're parts of Krishna. They're Krishna's minute aspect. Srila Prabhupada has also said that since Krishna is complete, he has his infinite aspect and his infinitesimal aspect also. So these spirit souls have this quality of independence and freedom, and they can actually use this quality or this potentiality to act independently of Krishna, and then Krishna goes along with that. But that is the actual contamination, if you like, because that becomes then the root cause of all the different misconceptions that the soul develops and all the different complicated happenings that occur then within the material world. So Krishna has arranged it that way. And it's a very deep subject matter. Ultimately, you can ask, well, why? But if it were not so, then how could there be love between Krishna and the living entities? Of course, you can say then, well, what is the nature of love anyway? And what do you really mean by that? But at least one has the possibility of, you can bring up this parable from the Bible, just for the fun of it, of the prodigal son, who, it's a story about how one son went away from home and another son stayed home. So then finally, the son who had gone away and was estranged from his father came back. So there's a great reunion of, with a great expression of affection by the father. And the son who had stayed home all the time said, well, you don't treat me like that. And I've been home all the time, so what's going on? But it seems then that this separation involved ultimately a greater expression of love. So it's a very deep subject as to why Krishna sets it up like this. But that's what seems to be involved there. So, yeah? No, Krishna doesn't enjoy that in the least. As I said, the only entity enjoying the material activities is the spirit soul. Krishna does not enjoy the activities going on within the material realm. Yes, Krishna is the enjoyer, but not of this. He is enjoying in the spiritual realm, and he enjoys spiritual relationships. The whole realm of Vaikuntha and Goloka Vrindavan is there, and Krishna is enjoying his eternal pastimes. The events within the material world are arranged by Krishna for the sake of the conditioned souls, but Krishna is not enjoying that. He's doing it for them, for their sake, and he's in control of the whole show, but he doesn't enjoy it. You know, there in the ocean, so many fish are devouring other fish. Right now, some fish with a mouth with teeth 3 inches long is stretching its mouth open to devour a fish 2 times as big as it is. This is going on in the ocean. And gradually it inches its mouth up and stretches it more and more and swallows this thing. So that's probably going on thousands of times right at this moment in the ocean. So what would God care about something like that? You know, it becomes so. What to speak of human activities? So Krishna doesn't enjoy any of this. He doesn't care for it. He can control it because he's infinitely powerful. So it's not that it's difficult for him to control the whole thing. He has infinite power. So just as we can do something like drive a car without really thinking about it. For example, I can drive a car and hold a conversation with somebody in the car. And I'm really thinking about the conversation. Of course, if you get too involved in the conversation, you're in trouble. But that shows that a human being has a certain power of attention that he can divide between two things. Well, Krishna has infinite power of attention. So he can run the whole material world and at the same time hardly even be paying attention to it. And he doesn't care about it. And matter itself, in and of itself, is not conscious of anything. Matter has no awareness. It doesn't have the chit potency. So then what is conscious of the material world and is enjoying it? Well, the conditioned souls are. The murderer may be thinking, by murdering this person, I will become happy. Somehow he's angry and he wants to get this person, and so he's thinking, I will be happy by doing this. So he's the one, the soul, not the material mind even, but actually the soul there is in the illusion of enjoying this. And the basic illusion is to lord it over matter. So murdering somebody is one way of trying to lord it over. So that illusion manifests in many different ways, in a kaleidoscopic fashion, and they're always changing from one thing to another. So it's that soul in illusion who's actually trying to enjoy this. But Krishna knows what's going on, but he doesn't care for it. Yes, the actions of the spirit soul are independent. Krishna is controlling them, but he says, I'm controlling this so that you can have your so-called enjoyment, and you're responsible. Krishna does not accept sinful reactions, because he's saying, well, look, the spirit soul is responsible for this. He's the one who wants it, and he also has to pay for it. So, I'll go straight.